This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, January 6th. Well, it is January 6th, and we are going to do an episode on the mob violence at the Capitol just last year in 2021. Of course, there is a lot of coverage and thinking and smart analysis on this first anniversary. The story of that day is still not fully written, so this is a little different for us because we often talk about kind of how history has seen a moment, how it's been sort of preserved in time. This is a very much a story that is still being written. But, you know, I think one thing we can do on this show, something we try and do for all of our episodes, is offer a little bit of that historical perspective. So here to do that are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
You know, we mentioned in the last episode that we did this taping in Boston and we don't have that audio. But one of the things we discussed there, because it was kind of looking back at the year of 2021 and the shows that we've done, you know, we did talk a little bit about the sort of themes that have emerged for each of us in doing this show and some of the sort of through lines that we've seen as we've done all these different stories throughout all the eras. That actually feels like good fodder for this moment. And what we want to do here is, you know, I'm curious to just tease out some of the bigger themes we've noticed about U.S. history and how they help us understand January 6th. Mm-hmm. Now, Kelly, you obviously write about, study, think a lot about political violence mm-hmm. in a different century. But yeah. let's start there. When you just think of this as a violent day and a violent act, how mm-hmm. does your historical work help put it in context?
Oh man, it's, you know, it's so troubling how we see history in some ways just repeat itself. I mean, in a lot of ways, what happened at the Capitol is unprecedented, for sure. Never happened before, certainly not in this way. But when we think about how violence gets galvanized among certain groups of people, how people have rallied around ideas of either white supremacy or an end to democracy or an overthrow of the government, what gets people mobilized to commit these kinds of heinous acts, that is certainly not new. We've seen all throughout history, in small, albeit often unsuccessful ways, people have taken up violence to create great amounts of harm. And I think we've seen it all throughout the antebellum period, certainly when it came to the issue of slavery. You certainly see it in the Civil War. I mean, mm-hmm. it is the Civil War. And then you see it again in Reconstruction when you have all of these racial mob attacks, massacres that happen to Black communities. And it's grievous is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Do you like that word mob? Is that a useful word as opposed to some of the other words people use?
I'm okay with mob. I'm okay with massacre. I do think I have a problem with riot. I think it depends on who was doing the violence or the destruction of property. I'd like to take up the work of Elizabeth Hinton, who talks more about rebellions when it comes to mm-hmm. urban rebellions and when it comes to urban unrest. But I think, I don't know, I do look at the Capitol and I see a riot.
Mm-hmm. And I just to underscore what Kelly's saying about this long history of opposition to democracy, I think that there's just this assumption that the thing that Americans are all on board with is small d democratic governance. And one of the things that we've seen again and again is that is not the only story in American history. I mean, certainly not for people who had their freedom and then their rights denied for hundreds of years. But also just, I mean, you see it, we talked on the show before about the 1898 Wilmington coup, where groups of white North Carolinians overthrew the biracial government that had been legitimately elected and put into place. And that is not quite the same as what happened in the Capitol on January 6th. But understanding that there are millions of Americans at any given time who are at least skeptical of democracy and mm-hmm. at most willing to use force of some kind in order to get what they want contra democracy is an important thing to keep in mind.
I don't know. I struggle with this a lot because I feel like the issue is often not democracy. I think the issue is just white supremacy. Right. I think that it's no coincidence that on the day that, you know, the insurrection happens, that the first black senator from Georgia is elected, the first Jewish senator from Georgia is elected. I think America has a hard time envisioning a multicultural democratic nation. I think that becomes the biggest rub for people. Not democracy itself, but who's entitled to it, who can benefit from it, who can be privileged by it.
It's a fight for defining what is democracy and who is democracy for and how expansive
is it. Yeah, who belongs?
The Wilmington thing is interesting. I mean, I think you want, yes, there are facile comparisons that maybe don't work, but I think one of the takeaways for me from when we talked about Wilmington, and I just think for a lot of the stuff we talk about, is just how much on a razor's edge a lot of these moments are. And for instance, in Wilmington, you know, we had this months and months long campaign to push back against a democracy that was emerging for all, a biracial democracy. But it came down to, you know, an hour in a room where someone basically confronted elected officials and said, you know, you're done, get out of here. Yeah. And just like that notion of there's the wheels of democracy and the gears are turning and someone just walking in and taking a stick and trying to put it into the gears of the democracy. And so like that feels very January 6th to me, where we can have these high-minded conversations about what was going on and all the history and the threads and themes that flowed into that moment. But at the end of the day, like it came down to an attempt to basically break into a room and stop a procedural thing from happening, which would have had massive ripple effects and probably, you know, just sort of sent this country. I mean, it probably already did send this country down another path, but certainly send this country down another path. And so that's just often when I think about what I've learned from this show, I often find myself just really trying to put myself in the like, in the room, in the very specifics of that moment.
Yeah. And January 6th also underscores your point about contingency. You could imagine a world in which a few different things happen and January 6th, there's no breach of the Capitol, you know, there's shouting and yelling, but it's no more than a kind of unruly protest. And you can imagine a January 6th, you can easily imagine a January 6th had things gone just a little bit differently, where members of Congress were killed, where the body count was much higher than what it actually was, or that, you know, the Congress wasn't able to get itself back together in order to certify the election. So I think that that was a moment in which you could feel at the time all of the contingencies burbling. And I think that had a lot to do with the fear and uncertainty that people were feeling, because it could have gone very differently.
Yeah. How fragile, just how fragile all of this is. It doesn't take as much effort as I think we might think. You know, when we think of like the overthrow of democracy, we think of some sort of like apocalypse or like some sort of like, you know, crazy over the top acts. I mean, that's what this was, but no one could have imagined, I think, it actually taking place in that way. But we were also warned, you know, these government officials were also warned, the FBI, the Capitol Police, they knew that people were coming. They knew that people were angry. So it's not completely out the blue either.
Well, talk about other stuff we've discussed on this show. You know, so often that's a theme that emerges too, is that there were warnings. And obviously hindsight lets you sort of cherry pick that out. But yes, like, you know, we've talked on this show about the plot to burn down Manhattan and how close that was during the end of the Civil War. And you know, just a couple little things go differently. And all of Lower Manhattan burns at the end of the Civil War because of Confederate operatives. But, you know, there were warnings about that. And so many of these things, there were warnings. This idea of, you know, who is democracy for? What kind of democracy do we have in this country? I mean, a lot of people have pointed to Reconstruction as another moment in this country where that was like an open question and people were fighting for that question. I'm just curious, you know, what lessons there are for Reconstruction and how that lens helps us understand January 6th.
Well, one lesson is that change can happen very quickly, progressive change. I mean, people have talked about the period of Reconstruction as the Second American Revolution, because you had this dramatic expansion of rights to a whole new group of people. And in the South in particular, you had these new biracial governments with people who were in government who just a few years earlier had been denied personhood. It's such a radical change, and that's a remarkable thing and something to hold on to in moments when you're feeling kind of dark about what's happening in the United States. But it's also a lesson of how quickly that can be taken away without any sort of formal recognition, right? That over the course of 10 or 15 years, that laws can be put in place first locally and then at the state level that strip a whole group of people of their rights. And I think that, you know, some people really cling to the idea that we are on an inevitable progressive path, right? That we're marching toward an ever brighter future. I don't think as many people hold that belief as did, say, 10 years ago. But I think Reconstruction is a signal lesson that democracy is not inevitable.
And yes, these are man-made constructs. Rules and laws are made by human beings in real time and who get together and do them. And you know, I think that cuts both ways, right? They can be dismantled and our country can go in awful directions, but also the progress we have made in this country is done the same way, you know, by real human beings who've decided to care and do something.
And also just a reminder that, like, people were exhausted by 1865,
yes,
and they had to get up and they had to continue to reconstruct the country in the aftermath of the war. And that was hard work. And there was a Klan to deal with and things looked darker all the time. And so for people who are feeling tired, sometimes you still got to get up.
No, that's such a good reminder. Yeah. And another thing I've learned, you know, from doing the show is like all the big things happen at the same time.
Yep.
And so just because one big thing is happening doesn't mean you then get to say, oh, well, other big things are happening and I have to ignore them and I'm exhausted by them. It's like, no, that's how it works. That's how history works. The big things pile on top of each other.
That's right.
One other thing I've been thinking about and is probably, I'm remembering now, is probably kind of my first take on January 6th. And Nikki, something you said sort of made me think about that sort of the details of the day emerging. I feel like often when you see a story playing out, you know, in a contemporary story playing out, as you gain more information, it sort of softens the edges or gives you context, or you realize like, oh, things weren't exactly as we first heard. This one, I just remember, and I continue to think, the more details you learn, the more outrageous it becomes. You know, it's more, and just even at first, I was like, well, you know, this looks crazy, but we'll learn a little bit more and get a sense of what was really going on. And it just played out the complete opposite from, I feel like, so many other stories of our time, where it's like, the more you learn, the more scary and intense and fraught and high stakes it seems to have been. And I think that's continued even over the past year. It's just a weird phenomenon.
Yeah, I think we saw that video. It might have been during the second impeachment hearing where they brought in the video cameras that were recording in the hallway. And you see this moment where Mitt Romney could have turned right and he turns left instead. And had he turned right, he would have run directly into a mob that was looking to you know, kill Mike Pence. Pence also came very, very close to where the mob was. And the more that you learn about that and the more that you learn about the organization behind it, right? This was a plot, a lot of it taking place, as you were saying earlier, in plain sight. January 6th was not a surprise in terms of the organization behind it. But just how much people had plotted out what they planned to do that day, how they planned to disrupt what was happening in the Capitol. I think the more details of that come out, the more you realize just how intentional what happened on the 6th was.
I also think, and Nikki and I have talked about this before, like the parallels about consensus and history and memory and how, like, when we get distance from this, like, what will be the narrative? What will be the story?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens after the Civil War and certainly during Reconstruction and a generation later is you get the lost cause, you get this alternative history in which Confederate soldiers get to be heroes and they get memorials and they get monuments and Robert E. Lee becomes this huge icon and the flag becomes this major relic. And I wonder what January 6th looks like when we fast forward a generation or two. Do we have a second lost cause history? Do we have different relics that get promoted or cemented within the public memory that change or shift the narrative of what happened? Because there are still large swaths of Americans that are like, that wasn't an insurrection. That wasn't really that bad. Which is mind-boggling now, but will it be so mind-boggling in the future?
This is something I worry about all the time, Kelly, because there already is a lost cause narrative that has completely taken hold. There's a good, I would say at least 40% of Americans who would say that January 6th was not an insurrection, that it was actually an attack on President Trump, that it was about the November 3rd election that had been stolen from President Trump, that the people who were arrested for their actions on January 6th are actually political prisoners. And so there is this full-blown lost cause narrative that exists and is popular and is an article of faith for somewhere between 30 to 40% of the country already.
And that Black Lives Matter is more violent and more heinous than what we saw on January 6th.
Absolutely.
And there's that larger context of just a capacity for violence and a growing willingness. And polling has shown this out. It's the sort of, I think, through line that has stuck with me from the rise of Trump. The sort of notion that violence is justified when you consider your political enemy truly evil, it sort of opens and unlocks this capacity for and tolerance of violence. And I think that there's twisted narratives about what really happened on that day, but then there's also just the thought that it's justified, you know, in some people's minds.
The double standard for me is that, like, Black violence, whether it existed or not, always gets magnified. And white violence, even when it's incredibly violent, gets trivialized and minimized. Because I think about, like, if this had been a Black Lives Matter, you know, attack on the Capitol, like, that just, none of this would have happened. None of this would have looked the same at all.
Yeah.
And there would be a consensus that it was a terrible thing that happened, and it was the worst crime in American history. And so, Kelly, I'm curious what you think about this, because, as you know, the lost cause narrative does become the consensus narrative, that there's this point by the late 19th century where both white Southerners and white Northerners kind of agreed that it was a noble cause on both sides, and can't we all just get along? And what do you think that consensus would look like? What would it take for Democrats and people who see January 6th as an insurrection, as this this great crime, to let that go in a generation?
I think it comes down to historians, because historians are the ones that are going to write the textbooks, that are going to shape the narrative, that's going to get filtered down through the journalists into the public, you know, memory and identity. And I think about, when I think about Reconstruction, I think about those old historian fathers that wrote these seminal textbooks, you know, like Dunning and his book, and his, the William Dunning School of Thought becomes the predominant narrative on Reconstruction, which was that it was a failure and that Black people were corrupt. Or I think about other major historians that had a huge role in shaping how we understand political and social and economic moments. I mean, this is why I think it's not too far off left field that there was such a controversy over, like, the 1619 Project, and it's who controls this narrative, who gets to shape what's said, who gets to tell what America is or who America is. That's a big part of the battleground that I think we often underestimate. But history is, I mean, this is why I love being a historian too. it's what we write about actually has consequences. There are major stakes involved because history is political.
And one thing I've learned from doing this show, and I think is worth, you know, I think about in the context of trying to process January 6th, is that the history starts to get written immediately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe not by historians with a capital H, who maybe take a little more time or whatever, but, you know, we did that episode about Attica, which I thought was such a phenomenal episode. But, you know, in there, I think one of the things that really stuck with me was that in the hours afterwards, the first press conference, you know, set a narrative about what happened and set a narrative about how prisoners in Attica were behaving versus how police forces were behaving. And we've seen that over and over and over in doing this show, that there are people there who will seize a narrative and be very strategic in the immediate aftermath of an event to try and direct sort of how history starts to get written, and everything is a product of that. And we are learning that. We saw it on January 6th, but we're learning that about mm-hmm. January 6th. I mean, I think one of the most stunning things that's come out in the last few weeks from the January 6th Commission is this notion that, you know, Fox News hosts were texting Trump and Mark Meadows directly, being like, this is out of line. This is ridiculous. Trump needs to get control here. And then that very night going on TV and saying it was Antifa, you know, and you see that double standard and that hypocrisy. Yes. But you also see that very concerted attempt to, from the very beginning, steer the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a kind of deliberate historical amnesia that starts almost immediately. Because of the power at stake.
Yeah, and because social media has allowed all of this is immediate. Right. You know, the moment you see it, you can text out or tweet out or post something completely false. And
people get to pick their narrative.
I mean,
to your point, Kelly, you know, I mean, I think you were talking about the Lost Cause is an era where I think you can get sort of quote unquote consensus, and you can get sort of the steering of the tanker, and largely and now I just don't know. I just think it's so fractured. People can just pick whatever narrative they want. And I don't know if consensus exists anymore, which is not to diminish the sort of need for a big, real, clear-eyed story to emerge. I just don't, it just so seems so much harder for that to happen these days.
Yeah, I co-sign with that, because I do think about how dominant the Dunning School was from like the 20s to the 70s. Yeah. And yet, we don't have one textbook writer. We don't have, kind of media environment in which a dominant narrative, a dominant consensus flourishes for people across the ideological spectrum. And so what this looks like in a generation, I think, will depend on what our media atmosphere looks like in a generation, and whether or not, you know, a democratic governance and liberal democracy is still intact in the United States a generation from now.
But listen, if 50 years from now, there's a statue to that shaman guy, I tap out. I'm done.
Oof, wow. Well, let's see. Can I ask you a question about returning to this question of mob violence and insurrection? And, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do in doing this show and feel like I've learned from this show is try to understand that at a given moment in history, these are real human beings who are sort of going through life and processing the moment. I try and just sort of, I think it's just useful, call it empathy, call it whatever, but, you know, just to go down to that human level and be like, what was it actually like in this moment? And that, you know, that goes for what was it like to be in the room where Andrew Jackson's parrot was cursing to what was it like to be, you know, at a huge weighty moment like this. Does that kind of thinking, though, for January 6th absolve people? Because, you know, it opens up this question for me of, were there a lot of people at January 6th who were there for a fun rally to cap off the Trump era and were swept up, you know, and this is the story a lot of them are telling. They're telling it, obviously, when the FBI comes knocking and it's convenient. But, you know, were they swept up? And should we sort of see that nuance, that there were people who were pushing this, there were people who were there to gum up the wheels of democracy, but then there were also people there who were swept up in the mob? How does that help us understand this moment, or what does it say?
I do think empathy is useful in a way, because there are a lot of different people there for a lot of different reasons, right? You can think about the America First Groypers, which is this far-right white supremacist group that was there. You know, they're there for a particular reason that's different from what thousands of other people were there for. They weren't there for a fun rally, right? They were there because they believed, truly believed, that the election had been stolen from Donald Trump, because that's what they were told by Donald Trump and by the media outlets they listened to. They sincerely believed that. And for some of them, they sincerely believed that in order to protect the United States, in order to protect the rule of law, that they had to, in that moment, engage in this pretty spectacular act of violence. And some of them might have gotten swept up in it. Some of them might have come there to pre-plan, but they all shared that common belief about the election. And that empathy then becomes useful, because it allows you to see the structures and the broader political context in which they were acting. And it allows you to, in some ways, assign blame to a much broader group of people than just the people who breached the Capitol.
I think that's exactly what I'm trying to get.
I don't think you get swept up and then just so happen to have zip ties in your backpack.
Well,
you
know, that's like, true. That's, no, yeah.
There's a real intentionality about a lot of the people who were there that were intending to create violence and harm and destruction. And that just can't be right. Sidestepped around. Yeah,
absolutely.
No, yeah. And, you know, people were there for different reasons and behaved in different ways, but they were all animated by the same thing, which was further upstream. And that starts, you know, with Trump, and it starts with the media environment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the level at which the conversation really needs to land for there to be any structural change, any actual change.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts, historical or in this moment? You know, where are you at on this anniversary?
I don't know. It still makes me sad. And it makes me sad because I think about Officer Dunn. I think about the black police officer that acted so heroically that day in the face of terrifying odds. I think about the people who lost their lives and their loved ones. I think about how much worse it could have been too. It's still very hard for me to to not think about January 6th and to not get just grieved by it in the same way that I would when I think about any sort of massive amount of violence that takes place. I think it's important that we feel that and that we really grapple with it.
Yeah, I think for me, I am deeply, deeply worried. You know, January 6th in a lot of ways, it wasn't just the singular event. It was a test. It was this moment of cataclysmic violence. You talked about those texts from Fox News hosts who were saying, this is terrible. You have to stop this. And you could imagine, I think, a world in which that was a wake-up call for some people. But instead, you have a very large portion of Americans who hit the snooze button immediately and went right back to the work of promoting the big lie. You know, you have Republicans that very night going back and voting to reject the electors' votes. And in the months since, what we've seen is a concerted campaign to strip power away from voters, to put it in the hands of Republican legislators and secretaries of state. And those kinds of things aren't big splashy events. They're not the things that are going to get the kind of news coverage and anniversaries that January 6th is going to get. And yet they are as harmful to our democracy, in part because a moment like January 6th couldn't stop them.
Yeah.
It didn't turn people off of the path that they were already going down with the lie about the 2020 election.
Yeah.
And so I think the U.S. is in pretty bad shape a year later.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying.
Yeah. And it's a reminder, I think, that the work of protecting democracy is not an every 2 year or every 4 year thing, and it has to be an ongoing thing. And I think just in whatever way the temperature needs to just stay up for people who care about democracy around this. And January 6th weirdly taught all the wrong people all the wrong lessons, right? Yep. For some people, it was like, oh, we got close and we can keep pushing in this direction to undermine democracy. And then for other people, it was like, well, we dodged a bullet. Let's take a breath for all sorts of reasons, you know, for some of which I'm empathetic to. But that's where my head's at, too, is just it needs to be, full time work at this moment in this country to shore up our democracy in every way we can. And I do think in some way that this anniversary is breaking out in some of those conversations that you see our political leaders using this anniversary as an opportunity to have these conversations. And I will be curious to see, I think the filibuster conversation and the Voting Rights Act as related to the filibuster is a big part of it. And we'll see if January 6th animates that push in any sort of way. And there's gerrymandering fights happening all around the country and there's voter access stuff. And, I just think, if people can connect to those lessons and to that work, I think that's the only sort of productive next step forward.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Yeah. Next episode, we will go back to just regular old what happened on this day a long time ago and how history has sort of put it. But it's the reason we do this show, I think, a historical perspective and looking at history as something that flows into the present and looking at the present as something that is a product of history is really important. And I think this episode has been a good example of that. So thank you for doing it. Nicole Hammer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
And listeners, if you have thoughts on this day, January 6th, please do get in touch. I'm curious to see, especially this question of how does a historical perspective help you process this moment. You can email us thisdaypod@gmail.com. You can email us after every episode. We really like getting your questions and thoughts and ideas for future episodes. But yes, on this day, if you are reflecting and processing, do get in touch, thisdaypod@gmail.com or on social @thisdaypod. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Kaola Nakua helps with transcripts. Julie Shapiro is executive producer for Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon. Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So, when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday.
Radiotopia.